You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Faye, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day.
When lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know.
When lightning strikes,
where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi, this is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, where we talk about the heart-thumping, tingly, mic-drop moment that led you to becoming an artist. My guest today is David Lindsay Abair, a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, screenwriter, lyricist, and librettist. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his devastatingly beautiful play, Rabbit Hole. The Hollywood Reporter said about Good People, another one of his devastatingly beautiful plays, it is that rare play that is both timeless and completely keyed into a specific moment in American life, bringing the same clear-eyed emotional observation that distinguished his Pulitzer Prize winner, Rabbit Hole. David Lindsay Abair has crafted another penetrating drama about deeply relatable issues. Some of his other brilliant plays include Funny Mirrors, Kimberly Akimbo, Wonder of the World, A Devil Inside, Ripcord, and on and on and on. And David also wrote the book for the musical High Fidelity, and the book and lyrics for Shrek the Musical. And if that's not enough, he's also a very prolific screenwriter. Some of his film credits include Robots, Inkheart, Rise of the Guardians, Poltergeist, The Family Fang, and the film versions of Rabbit Hole and Shrek the Musical. And most recently, he's written just a plethora of monologues for the 24-hour plays Viral Monologues, writing pieces for Rachel Dratch, Marcia Gay Harden, J. Smith Cameron, Joanna Day, Cynthia Nixon, Amy Garcia, Michael Urie, David Hyde Pierce, Mary Louise Burke, T.R. Knight, and Jake Gyllenhaal. I had to mention them all because they are a feast. They are absolutely spectacular, these Viral Monologues. And David is also the maestro of decorating Halloween houses. His home is called the most impressive Halloween house in Brooklyn. Google him and Halloween, or go to his Twitter feed, and you'll see what I mean. Welcome, David.
Oh my God, that is such a nice introduction. I have to say, the thing I'm proudest of is the Halloween decorating. I had no idea that you would mention it. And by far on that list, that's the thing I'm proudest of. Thank you.
Are you really? out of your repertoire of work, it's the Halloween. It is pretty amazing.
Well, it's also secret, and I haven't gotten any bad reviews for it, so that helps.
That's true. well, let's. There's so much to talk about. Can we talk about your lightning strikes moment when you knew you had to be an artist?
Well, this is the hardest question, and I know it's the whole premise of your show. And when you asked me to do it, I thought, well, good Lord, I don't really have the thing. What I have, and I'm happy to describe, are more like three mini lightning strikes. The first one being when I was, you know, 8 or 9, my uncle took my sister and some cousins to see Annie, the touring production of Annie. I grew up in South Boston. And so Annie was playing at the Colonial Theater. And, you know, I knew nothing about theater. My family is incredibly working class. So there were no theater people in it other than this wonderful actor, uncle of mine, who did some community theater. And he brought us all to see Annie. And it was an amazing thing because there were their kids up there performing their hearts out in this gigantic, gorgeous theater. So that was, you know, my first flash of wow, theater is amazing. That said, I never considered it something that I could pursue. I certainly didn't think of the writers of it in particular. It just seemed like this wonderful foreign thing that had nothing to do with me. But still, it made an impression. And that same uncle brought us to see the touring production of Peter Pan. And so there would be these theater events in Boston that I would go to that I loved. But again, it was just a special thing. And then later, I got a scholarship to Milton Academy, which is this very Tony private school out in the suburbs. And I was the poor kid from Southie that would get on the subway every day and go to this private school starting in 7th grade. And in 9th grade, what happened at this school was every 9th grade did a 9th grade play. And our 9th grade play was actually a musical by Christopher Durang called A History of the American Film. And it's just this ridiculously funny, absurdist, of course, it's Chris Durang, wonderful musical that I was in with all of my fellow classmates, and I played a bunch of different parts in it, and just had the time of our lives. And so I loved being in theater, and I loved that show in particular. And when that show was finished, a classmate said, you know what, we should do a 10th grade play, which had not been done at the school. After 9th grade, you just get dumped into the whole school and everybody auditions for everything. And so this friend of mine said, you should write a 10th grade play because you're the funny one. And so that's how I became a playwright, just because a friend said, you should do this. Again, it wasn't exactly a lightning moment because I didn't think, oh, now I will become a playwright. I just did this thing that I loved doing. And then I wrote an 11th grade play and a 12th grade musical with one of my best friends. And again, not really thinking that I would pursue it necessarily. So that was the second lightning strike. I then went to Sarah Lawrence College primarily as an actor. I loved acting. And just to fill up my theater program, I continued to take playwriting classes and I continued to write plays. And after I got out of Sarah Lawrence, I worked for a couple years. I continued to write plays. Again, I'm so in denial about being a playwright. I met a fellow playwright named Stephen Belber. I had submitted a play of mine to a contest in South Carolina that I had won. And I met Stephen Belber there. And he said, do you know about the Juilliard program? And I said, no, tell me more. And he said, well, it's essentially a fellowship. It's a graduate program, but you don't have to pay anything. In fact, you get a little money to attend. And it's run by Marsha Norman, one of my idols, and Christopher Durang, who wrote that very first musical that I was in 9th grade. So I applied to Juilliard, and I got into Juilliard. And, it, you know, they only let in 3 or 4 playwrights a year. And maybe on the first class, Marsha and Chris were saying things like, well, as a playwright, you will encounter this and that, or as a playwright, you may have an encounter with a director that will go like this. And I swear to God, it wasn't until that moment in that class where they were speaking to me as a playwright that I thought, oh, I guess this playwriting thing might work out. So, I mean, that was the real moment, but I was in denial about it for so many years. And that I think just might be a byproduct of being a working class kid where, you know, I didn't know any playwrights. It didn't seem like a feasible occupation. And also as a working class kid, you always have a plan B, which is even if you dare to dream about something impossible, like being a playwright or working on Broadway, for God's sakes, is like, well, that will never happen. So I better make sure that I have, you know, I can type and work in an office should that happen.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
In my dentist's office.
More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
That's so extraordinary, you know, how. I'm thinking of just in the 10th grade, or has somebody just said to you, why don't you write it? And mm-hmm. you said, yeah, I'll do that. And I even love the story about how you got to the school, that it was that there was a scholarship, right, that was given mm-hmm. away once every 6 years, and it was usually right. an athletic scholarship, and that the boys club, the people who worked at the boys club really championed you and got you.
Yeah, I had no idea. Yes, I had no, well, I mean, luck plays a huge role in my life. So that once every 6 years thing, you know, you had to be the exact right age on the year that the scholarship became available. I did not know that it was an athletic scholarship until many years after, like literally 30 years after I got that scholarship. The New York Times was doing a story about me. I think Good People was opening. So we went back to South Boston and I met with these women that worked at the Boys and Girls Club. And they said, gosh, I remember how contentious that staff meeting was. And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, you know, that was an athletic scholarship. And, you know, there is nothing athletic at all about me. And still, these two women put my name forward for an athletic scholarship. Ridiculous. And I got to Milton and I did the interview and I brought, you know, a stack of poems and some paintings I had. And Milton, God bless them, decided to let me in anyway, despite the fact that it was an athletic scholarship. It also explained, you know, the third weekend when the phys ed teacher said, are you that kid from Southie? I said, yeah. You don't play hockey? I said, no, I don't really play any sports. So what kid from Southie doesn't play hockey? And he seemed so angry because he, and I, again, 30 years later, I found out, oh, he thought he had this ringer coming in from South Boston to beef up his hockey team. Yeah. Instead, this poet walked in the door. He was very disappointed.
Can you talk about that 10th grade play that you wrote? What was it? Do you remember?
I remember very well. It was just terrible. I can tell you that. Oh. But nobody told me it was terrible, and we had the time of our lives. One of the great things about Milton is they exposed me to amazing plays, and one of them being Tina Howe's play Museum. They had done, you know, the upperclassmen had done some production of Museum, which just is a ridiculous, absurdist play, which is wonderfully funny. And, you know, three people will come into the museum and they have a little scene and then they leave and then four more people come in and it has sort of a plot, but not really. Anyway, my play is a complete ripoff of Museum. It was called Mario's House of Italian Cuisine, and it was set in a restaurant and had like 35 parts for all of my friends. And they would come in and they would do a little scene and sit at a table and then they would leave. I mean, it was very much like Museum, not nearly as good, but we just had a complete and utter blast.
What gave you those tools, though, to know that, okay, I could do this. I can write dialogue. I could pick up a pet. I could write a play.
Oh, God only knows. I mean, just, you know, I don't know. Someone asked me to do it, so I did it. It just seemed like, oh, that'll be fun. By the way, that pretty much defines my entire career. Someone saying, do you want to do this thing that you've never done before? And I go, okay, sure. Musical. Okay. I'll write a musical. I'll write a horror movie. I guess. Why not? You're asking me to do it. So it started, yes, all the way back in 10th grade. Why don't you write a play? Okay. So I did it. I'm highly suggestible.
And can you talk about Juilliard and more about how that experience changed you being there and deciding, okay, I'll hang that playwright shingle on me now. Yeah. You know, I'm like, you know, I'm going to embrace that. And yeah, you know, I think about how competitive the program is, and what it was. What was it that you wrote for them to get in?
Oh gosh, the play that I submitted, because you have to submit a play, was one of my very first plays. It's called The Devil Inside, which was produced at Soho Rep. It was produced the summer before I got into Juilliard. So when I submitted it, it had no productions attached. But that play, Devil Inside, was really over the top and absurdist, and was inspired by 19th century Russian novels that I had studied a lot at Sarah Lawrence. And it's just a ridiculous play that is, not surprisingly, a little similar to a Christopher Durang play. And so it was tonally very similar to Chris, who was an influence. And I found out later who had also been deeply influenced by 19th century Russian novels. But I didn't know that at the time. So it seemed like a good match in terms of getting into Juilliard. But once I got into Juilliard, I mean, it's a very small program. As I said, they only let in 3 or 4 writers a year. And it's a 2-year program, so there are usually 8 other writers in the room. So you get amazing attention from Christopher Durang and Marcia Norman, who are 2 of the smartest people you could ever meet. And so what's great about the program is they focused on your voice as a playwright, and they wanted to support you and encourage you, and they wanted you to write the best version of whatever play you wanted to write. And so they just gave us room and love and support, and we wrote plays. So that was half the program. And then the other half of the program is they just would talk to us about what it means to be a playwright, just living the life of a playwright. How do you have a family and be a playwright? How do you get work and be a playwright? How do you deal with directors while being a playwright? All these things that Marcia Norman would later go on to call the dark arts. And so we would read our plays to each other and respond. And then we would have a dark arts session after that, saying, what's on your mind this week? What has happened with you all that you want to talk about that we can advise you about? So it was just the most amazing 2 years of my life. And while I was there, I wrote Fuddy Mears. That's where I wrote my play Fuddy Mears, that was first produced actually at Juilliard before it went to Manhattan Theater Club. I'm still in a writer's group that started after a bunch of us graduated from Juilliard and said, well, what do we do now? And my friend Daniel said, well, let's just do what we did at Juilliard, but we'll meet in each other's living rooms every 2 weeks. And we'll just respond to each other's work. And that, you know, all these years later, that group still exists. It's changed and it's grown. And one more full circle thing, Christopher Durang decided to retire 5 years ago. And I got the call saying, would you like to take Christopher Durang's seat? And so I've been co-directing the program for the past 5 years, first with Marcia Norman, who was, you know, my mentor and who I love so much. And just this year, Marcia retired, and I'm now co-teaching with Tanya Barfield, who's a wonderful playwright who also went through the Juilliard program and who has been in my writer's group for the past 20 odd years. And so now Tanya and I are sitting in Marcia and Chris's seats teaching.
Oh, the full circle-ness is so delicious. What does that give you, teaching and young playwrights and people who are just entering the profession?
I love everything about it. And I didn't know that I would. When they offered me the job, I thought, oh gosh, how will this affect my writing? Will it take away from my own writing? And actually, the time load isn't that much. But I find it completely inspiring, honestly. And it's, you know, without being corny about it, I left every class feeling like, oh, I want to go home and write my own play. And so it's just thrilling to be in a room with 8 exciting writers that are creating new stuff and have a fresh outlook on the world and have their own voices and points of view. It's just amazing. It's also having to respond to the work every class keeps my own craft sharp, because, you know, I can't not respond in a way without thinking, oh, this applies to my own work. And I have to remember, oh, right, how to keep characters active and just basic craft stuff that is good to keep sharp in my own toolkit, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And what I love is that here you are, the same playwright or the same writer wrote Rabbit Hole and Shrek and Good People. Yeah, I think about and Funny Mirrors, that they're all very different kinds of, but they all have people or maybe non-people who I care about deeply. And I feel like I get inside of them. What is that process for you of when you have that blank page or the blank screen? Do you mind sharing what that's like for you when you approach a play or screenplay?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's changed over time, I have to say. You know, when I first started writing, it was just following impulses, honestly. And trying to get excited about my character and what their dilemma was, and getting inside their own heads, getting inside their heads, and trying to bring that stuff to life. Now I'm, because I'm older and I've learned a lot more about craft, I do try to think of things ahead of time instead of just winging it. It's hard to write from the seat of your pants, and so I do try to think, okay, what is something that I'm worried about? Or what is something, how do I even talk about it? It's so hard to talk about writing. But how do I create a character that wants something desperately? And what happens if they don't get it? I mean, that's very basic playwriting, actually, but it's something that you have to remind yourself about. And so if I think, look, just to be specific, Good People was about a woman that was in a very disparate situation. I knew that I wanted to write about South Boston, which is where I'm from. I never had done that before. And I knew that I wanted to write about, to some extent, class in America, hopefully not in a didactic way.
Yes.
But then I thought, okay, so this woman who is like so many people that I know from South Boston, this woman who is, you know, has a lot of my mom in her, what happens if this woman loses her job in the first scene? Okay, great. Not great, but now I know what she wants. She needs to not get kicked out of her apartment, and she needs to feed her daughter. And so that becomes the journey of the play. How does this woman pay her rent? It's so basic, but then once you have that seed, you can then make things more and more difficult for her and push things up against her and have her push back. But you have to start with an idea that feels like that's stage worthy. And that the stakes are great enough that people yes. will be invested and want to watch that story.
And I think about the stakes there, and there's this incredible scene where Frances McDormand's character Maggie, right?
Maggie is
talking about how it started with peanut brittle, how her demise. Per se, or how she kept losing because she ate peanut brittle to save mm-hmm. money, and she lost a tooth, and she had to, in this sort of Sophie's Choice kind of dilemma, not to be so dramatic, she had to choose between a car payment to get her to work on time or going to a dentist to fix an abscess tooth. You know, and it's so heartbreaking, but you understand it in a very base way, in such a relatable way, you know, how she has to make this choice. And it's devastating, you know, that you bring us there. You know?
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, these are the people that I know and love, and, you know, a lot of people in the country now more than ever are living on the precipice and living literally day to day. And the tiniest setback can set off a series of events that could lead to just terrible catastrophe for folks. And so, yeah, breaking a tooth, what am I going to do? I have to pay the dentist. If I pay the dentist, I can't make the car payment. If I can't make the car payment, I can't get to work. If I don't get to work, then I get kicked. Then I get fired from my job. If I get fired from my job, I can't pay my rent. If I can't pay my rent, I'm kicked out of my home. And then I'm homeless because I decided to bite on a piece of peanut brittle. Right. And that's so many people. I wanted to write about them. Also, not the kind of people you often see on stage.
Yes.
And so I wanted to give a home to those folks on stage.
And what's so extraordinary, I mean, to the 24-hour plays, the monologues you've written, that they really cast this this beautiful spotlight on what we're going through right now. You know, I'm thinking about they're all so extraordinarily powerful. I'm thinking about Marcia Gay Harden's One Normal Thing, and they have these twists and turns, and I'm not going to give it away, but there is this one line that it was like a haiku or crystallizing so much of what we're going through right now, is where she says, "Poor dad, the guy lives to be 83 years old, fights in two wars, only to be taken out by someone with a cough. All he's accomplished, only to die alone in some hospital room." And I actually had to rewind several times because it just stopped me in my tracks, that monologue. And it was...
Well, thanks. She did it so beautifully. Yeah, beautiful. So that's very kind. I mean, these 24-hour monologues have been so interesting to me. For the listeners who don't know, the 24-hour plays generally are plays that are written overnight, and I've done a bunch of Broadway benefits, and you know, a playwright writes a play overnight, and the actors show up in the morning, and they memorize it, and it's mounted that night on Broadway. So with the monologues, very similarly, I'm assigned an actor, or I hook up one of my friends, and then I write a monologue overnight, and they're sent the monologue around 9 a.m. or something, and they have to memorize it and record it by that night, and it's online at like 6 p.m. that night. So what's interesting about this exercise for me, because I've never really written in real time. You know, a lot of my plays, like I think back to my time in South Boston, or I think back to a time when I was terrified of losing my child, or whatever it is. There's a lot of reflection, and that's not what's happening with these 24-hour plays. I am writing about the world as it's happening, and I've never done that. And so, you know, I've done, I think, 12 of them now over the course of these many months. And for me to watch, I can just track my own little psychological journey through the pandemic by clicking on each of these monologues. And so one week I think, oh, this is just absurd. And so Rachel Dratch does a very funny monologue. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, I am terrified of what's going on. And you know, 2 weeks later, I am incredibly angry. And then you get Cameron's very angry monologue. And then with Marcia Gay Harden's monologue, it's, you know, I've been incredibly sad a lot of the time and terrified for people that I love. And so anyway, each of those monologues are just a little window into what was David Lindsay Abaire feeling this week? And hey, great, Cynthia Nixon, will you do that for me? And Michael Euring, will you do that for me? And it's been a wonderful experience. And those actors are all just so wonderfully game and talented, and I owe them a great deal.
And don't they give you a prompt or of some kind, right? They give you some kind of inspiration?
Yes, they often do. Yeah, the night before they send you a little video saying, "Hi, I'm Michael Urie and I can film here in my apartment. And here's my dog. If you can work my dog into the monologue." And, you know, "Oh, I've always wanted to fill in the blank." And so I've used a lot of those prompts because they can help when it's, you know, 1 a.m. and you still haven't written anything. But I haven't always used them, but often I have, yeah.
And how are you getting through this time? Is this helping you, the writing the viral monologues? Has it been helping you heal, not to sound so dramatic, or helping you get through this moment?
For sure, yes. Healing's not too dramatic a word. I feel healed by them. I mean, just accomplishing something is a huge thing. Just feeling like, oh, I've created something in the midst of this insanity. So just feeling like you've done something and put it out into the world, that's a great thing. But you know, it's weird being a writer too, because we are, you know, among the rare breed of artists that can in fact continue to work during this time. And so my deadlines are still my deadlines, and I'm doing what I would normally do. You know, the extra ingredient is, well, there's several extra ingredients. One is my children are around all the time. So that's new and wonderful most of the time. But then there's just the anxiety of the world that we live in that can be debilitating. And, you know, I know a lot of artists that are having trouble creating, even though they have nothing but time and space. Their brain is occupied by how awful the world is. I mean, the pandemic and the racial strife and our crazy president. And I sympathize and empathize with all of the people that are not having an easy time creating right now.
Do you have a certain time or a chunk of time when you have to be writing, or does it, or is it when you know, the muse comes, or not when the, but you know, is there at least some people I know, they have to start writing at 6 a.m. and they keep office hours and they don't answer emails and they don't, what is your ritual?
Well, I definitely keep office hours. I generally start at 9 a.m. and I work until 6. And so again, I think that's just the working class mentality. It's like, this is your job. You go for these hours and you have a lunch at this time. And so I'm very strict about it. I work all day, every day. You know, unfortunately, a lot of that day is spent responding to emails and looking at Facebook a little too often. But I'm still at the desk and mostly doing my job. And, you know, I do a lot of stuff with film and television, as you've mentioned. And so there are always deadlines. The harder part is trying to squeeze in sometimes the theater stuff, which is, of course, much more where my heart is. And so I try to put aside, okay, these 2 hours are for that new play. No matter what, you have to do those 2 hours in the play. Or Janine Tesori and I are working on a new musical. You have to finish that song before you, you know, work on that thing that you said you're going to do for HBO. So it's balancing.
I love that you're reunited with Janine. I mean, I got to see a little bit of your, well, not a little, I got to see some of your collaboration with one of the viral 24-hour monologues.
Oh, right. Jake Gyllenhaal song.
Which is just delightful. And I'll let people watch it. It's just so special and a window into that a world that's really beautiful.
It's literally set at a window.
And it's set at a window. And then, and so you're back with Janine from your collaborator on Shrek, right? So I know you can't tell us too much. Is there anything you're...
Sure. Yeah, I can say a little bit. I just can't announce what it is because it hasn't been announced yet. But no, Janine and I did Shrek together. And Shrek was wonderful and really difficult for all kinds of reasons that you can imagine. But the best part of Shrek was working with Janine. And so I afterwards I said, gosh, that was really hard. Let's do this again, but maybe not work on something that's based on a giant movie that has, you know, several Hollywood producers involved and everybody walks into the theater with an opinion about it before they've sat down, whether the opinion is good or bad. It would be better if people had a clean slate like they do when I write a play. And Janine was like, yes, let's do something small. And how about one of your plays? And I said, what do you mean? She said, do you have an old play that maybe we could adapt and turn into a musical? And I was like, oh, I don't. Me? She's like, how about this one? And so she pulled, I can't say which one it is. But anyway, we've adapted one of my older plays and have had a complete and utter blast. It's so wonderful working with her. I love her. I love her work. And the process has been so easy. You know, we just slopped around for as long as we needed to, and we didn't have to put it in front of anyone until we were ready to put it in front of people. And so that show is supposed to be running right now, but obviously it's not because of the coronavirus. But it will be going up next season. We're very, very excited about it.
I love her work too. I love Violet. I mean, that's just one of my favorite. And Caroline or Chick. So what a duo you, what's the yin and yang of you? And do you work together? I mean, now do you work separate? Well, now. How do you work also?
Yeah. The yin and yang. Well, I'll tell you, there's definitely a yin and yang. I am much more, maybe it's already become apparent in this interview, but I am very much a structuralist. And so I like an order to things and I like the math of story structure and song structure and all of that. And Janine is just wild in terms of structure and where she goes musically and the way her brain works. And so she has loosened me up in incredibly useful ways. And I put up the guardrails in a way that she says is very helpful to her. And so it's worked out wonderfully. Generally, the way we work is we'll pick a moment in whatever the material is that we're going. We say, is this a musical moment? And we talk about it. And we talk about it. And then I go away and write the scene, and then that goes into the song. And then I write the song, the lyric, and whatever I think the lyric might be, I then will include with the document that I send to Janine, 8 or 9 pages of noodles, which are things that didn't make it into the song, but were just little impulses I had that I didn't follow through. And so Janine will go through the song. Maybe she'll like it as is. Generally, she'll say, I like this part, but this noodle down here, this little stanza, I think that's the hook, don't you? And what if we move that up here and this B section actually becomes the bridge? And I go, oh my God, that's so much better. And it's always better. And so then I go back and I rewrite it with that in mind and send it to her. And she says, this is so much better. Great, great, great. I was thinking about this for the C. And then the bridge, I'll say, I mean, Janine, that feels like 3 different songs. Can we just like boil it down to something simpler? And she go, you're absolutely right. How's this? And that's how it is. It goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth like that. So it's incredibly collaborative. I don't think, maybe only once, have I ever sent a lyric that she said, great, here's the tune, and then it was written. No, everything becomes a process. But it's wonderful.
How is it different than writing a play, you know, at the process of writing a song, or when you're collaborative like that for you, than writing a play?
Well, you're sharing it. I mean, that's the main thing. You're making it better with another person.
Yeah.
Also, you know, I think I know how to write scenes now at this point. But Janine, a song is just it's a totally different animal. And so it has a structure like a song, and a character generally starts one place and ends at a different place. So there's usually an event in a song or a revelation of some kind. So that's all true. But it can go to so many different places musically that Janine opens me up to things that I just didn't have access to before she came along. So it's been really interesting to actually adapt a play of mine that I felt I knew so well to then crack it open and turn it into a completely different thing that breathes and walks and moves around in a completely different way through music and song. It's been wonderful.
I can't wait. Has it completely transformed how you view this piece of how you view the play now? I know you can't say whether it
is. Yes and no. I mean, I can't imagine. It's funny. It's hard. It's a very specific play. I can't really imagine it as a play anymore. It's the shape of it is still the same, and most of the characters are the same, and what happens is the same. But now we get to hear their internal lives in a way that, you know, was just subtext in the play. And so to give voice to their hearts like that, if I saw the play, I would miss the songs, I think.
Oh, so wonderful how things evolve.
Yeah, for sure.
And I know it's hard to talk about writing, but I just love your dialogue. And I think about how each of your characters has a life of their own and a very specific, you know, point of view. I mean, they're very uniquely drawn. Is it hard to describe how you write dialogue or some of the best guidance you've gotten in your career about how to write dialogue, how to bring these people to life? Or that's too hard. I understand.
No. Yes, it is hard. First of all, thank you. You're very generous to say that. It's also not the dialogue. It's not something I honestly think about, because the task of writing is like characters need to say something. What are they going to say? Well, they want something. And so how would they go about asking for it. Well, it has to be specific to who they are, what is their relationship to the character that they're talking to, what is their point of view. So the more I figure out who the character is, then their voice becomes clearer. And once their voice becomes clearer, how they talk and what they say just becomes inevitable, if that makes sense. So I also think it helps that I did so much acting early on that I tried to create characters that I would want to play as an actor. And so I tried to write dialogue that I would want to say if I were an actor. So there aren't really there aren't small parts in any of my plays. Mm-hmm. I everybody gets their moment, because that's, you know, when I was in ninth grade, all I wanted was my moment. I didn't need a huge part, but if it was, you know, if it had a little arc and I needed something, then that was something to play and that would be fun. And so the dialogue comes out of that. I mean, it also, sometimes I write with an actor in my head, not a lot, but Mary Louise Burke has been in nearly all of my plays. So if I get in a jam dramatically in a scene, like, oh God, how do I get out of this? I think, oh, well, what if Mary Louise Burke was playing this part? And then it just comes. It's like, oh, of course, this is so much easier if I have Mary Louise in my head. Or with good people, like those were not literally based on people that I knew, but I certainly knew the type of people they were. And people in South Boston speak in a very specific way, with a very specific kind of humor and sadness and need and desperation and passive aggressiveness. Mom, that made the dialogue very easy to write.
So it's almost like they're talking to you. You let you and you give them voice, or you listen.
That's it.
And is there a role that you loved playing when you were acting? Would you go back to acting?
Oh my God. I would, if someone offered me a part, I would love that. I have no interest in auditioning or anything like that. The pursuit of acting.
Yeah. Would you write a part for you and put yourself in it?
No, there are so many better actors than I am. No. One of my favorite shows that I in high school that I did was A Flea in Her Ear, where I was the lead. I played twins. And so just the joy of playing twins and doing ridiculously fast costume changes backstage and entering on the other side of the set 2 seconds later in a totally different costume as a different character and have the audience go, what? How the hell did that? That also, it's a very, very funny play with revolving beds and just, I love a farce. If that wasn't evident. I know Rabbit Hole doesn't have a lot of farcical elements, but Funny Mirrors does, and a lot of them do. So I loved being Flea in Her Ear. I was also Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, is it true? I read that Funny Mirrors is going to be a movie. Is that right?
Good Lord. I don't know, Gerald. It's been in development for so long.
Oh, forgive me.
I mean, the director, David Petrarca, who directed the play, has been attached to it. And, you know, every few months I hear of an update, but movies are so weird. Maybe it'll get turned into a movie someday.
And I must ask you about your Halloween house.
I've been waiting. That's what I most want to talk about.
Okay. Yes. I read this about description. That's just too wonderful. There are skeletons climbing the turret, dead bodies and other creatures buried in the front yard, witches and jack-o'-lantern ghouls taking up all the room on the porch, creepy dolls, giant spider webs, and ridiculous handmade clown paintings. When night comes, video projections of ghosts and spirits appear in windows up above. And many other creatures come to animatronic life as well, with plenty of creepy noises to boot. Oh, my goodness. Tell me more.
I mean, you just told it all. What more do you need?
How did this happen? And I saw that Good Morning America was there. Right?
They appeared in my lawn one morning. Yes.
So it's alive and well, even this year.
It's so funny that you're at, I mean, I literally took it down this morning. Okay. I was racing with my hammer to get the skeletons off the side of the turret thinking, oh crap, I got to do Gerald's podcast in 20 minutes. I got to finish this up. So it's coming down as we speak. To answer how it all came to be, when we live in Ditmas Park, and when we moved, we got very lucky. We got this lovely corner house with a nice wraparound porch. But when we moved in, some neighbors down the block said, hey, we host this Halloween parade every year, and our kids are older now. Would you like to host it? And we said, you know, suckers. We were like, okay, yes. Little did we know what we were getting into. At that time, it really was just a family parade where, you know, 10 or 12 families with their kids in costumes would walk to the end of the block. And so we hosted that. But when we did, I said to my wife, well, we should decorate a little bit if we're hosting a Halloween parade. So I got, you know, three animatronics and some orange lights, and that was the extent of it. And then the next year, I thought, well, we should get a few more animatronics because we can't just have three. Look at this big porch. We should fill it up a little bit. So I then got, you know, three spooky clowns and a couple witches to add the three that we had. And by the way, we need many more lights, of course. Cut to 8 or 9 years later, now I have 60 animatronics. 60. The parade is no longer just the 12 families. Over 1,000 people show up. We have a permit to block off the street. We're giving out brownies and cupcakes and popcorn, and it's a huge neighborhood event that we love. The parade itself was canceled this year because of Corona. But the decorations, I still put them out. I almost didn't this year because I thought, oh God, I don't want people gathering on the lawn and becoming a hotspot and ending up in the New York Post. But then enough neighbors said, oh my God, please, when the kids are begging me to know when the decorations are going up, I have to get them out of the house. So I thought, oh crap, I guess I have to put up these decorations. So I did, and I put signage saying, please wear your masks and stay 6 feet apart. And people obeyed all the rules. And this was the first year that we got cards and notes in the mailbox thanking us for the decorations. It seemed like because it's such a miserable year, it meant more to everyone this year than it had in the past. And I'm so glad that we did it.
Gosh, do you try to top it every year? I mean, my goodness. And the creativity and ingenuity of this is astounding.
Well, there's a lot of maintenance involved because these animatronics are wonderful, but not very well made. And so I'm constantly swapping them out, trying to repair them. So there are always new ones in the mix. But I shouldn't, my wife may listen to this podcast, so I'll say, no, I will not top myself. I think she's done. It is literally the entire wraparound porch, and it has moved up to the second floor, and we're putting projections in windows. We can't really do any more without my getting a divorce. So I'm not going to top myself. We're just status quo now.
And what is it like for your kids? My God, it's like living in the North Pole. Santa's workshop.
they love it. They don't feel inclined to help me set any of it up. My youngest was a little scared of a few of the animatronics early on, but he's 12 now, so he's fine with all of it. So no one's scared except for the occasional Con Ed guy who does, you know, everything is stored in the basement. And I sometimes forget to warn people that go down in the basement. Oh, by the way, there are 60 zombies and creepy clowns down there. So I will startle a Con Ed person every once in a while. But the kids love it.
Were you a Halloween person as a kid?
I mean, as much as any kid was, I loved it. And I loved scary movies. So I loved it.
Oh gosh. Well, I can't wait for next year to see it.
Well, it'll be here.
It'll be here. Well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, David. I cannot thank you enough for being on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Gerald. This has been terrific.
It's been terrific. Well, have a wonderful day and stay safe.
Thank you so much. Every day when lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know. The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore. and the talent was booked by Anna Stroud.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.